Previously on the Leaky Bucket podcast.
You're depressed. I was like, oh no, I'm depressed. Shit. So then you start carrying around like a label. I'm depressed. So how am I going to hold myself? Well, like this, and I'm going to talk really slowly. And well, I am depressed. So it was that kind of diagnosis. It was very damaging. So I was like, I need to get back to work, rush back to work way too quick. Went back in literally the first week of February, and I shouldn't have gone back in. I was nowhere near ready to go back. And they could see that it was harming me in different ways. I wasn't performing right. Long story short, I lost that job. So now I'm jobless. Two family members passed away. Relationships ended. I'm 30. In my mind, I should have the kids, the house, the white picket fence, the Labrador, like everyone tells you you should. And so I've never felt lower at this point.
Hi there, and welcome to the Leaky Bucket podcast. I'm your host, Ian Morgan, and this is the financial performance podcast for entrepreneurs looking to get a better understanding of their numbers, to plug the leaks in their business, and to move from surviving to thriving. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Leaky Bucket podcast. Today, we have with us Jeremy Hurwitz, who has forged a unique career at the crossroads of sales, intelligence, and international journalism, which has led to the creation of Sell Like a Spy. It's a business development lessons and communication strategies from the world of espionage. He teaches executive clients and conference audiences how to leverage spy tradecraft into their salesmanship and their everyday lives to connect more deeply with others and overcome challenges. Jeremy, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Jeremy, first of all, let's get people a little bit behind the scenes. Let's get people to know you. What is it that you're most well known for? Is it the Sell Like a Spy sort of approach, or is there something else?
Well, let's see. I've done a number of different things. In addition to all the stuff you described, I'm also a pretty active musician, so some folks know me that way as well. But I probably say as a writer, I've been writing since my early 20s, and I write quite regularly. I've recently been writing for The Hill, the USA Today, Bloomberg, and perhaps they know me as something of a critic of China. That's how I've written quite a bit. So maybe that's how they best know me.
Great. What do people misjudge about you the most?
People misjudge about me. You know, I think I'm a bit of a chameleon. So, you know, if people have encountered me at certain business moments in a suit, they might not know me as somebody, you know, very active in the arts. In the same way, I think even more regularly when I am in that arts world, people don't know that I engage in essentially corporate espionage and have done a lot of work for banks, private equity firms, hedge funds, which are not really part of the other world I encounter. So I like to think of myself as having kind of a couple identities that I can leverage. And I think that goes to the heart of some of what I teach with Sell Like a Spy.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me with the concept that you've got behind them. What are the three most important values that you live by?
Yeah, great question. I care a lot about ethics and honesty. So I'm fairly obsessed with trying to do the right thing. I spend too much time on it. My wife will tell you that I'm too quick to apologize when I might have done something wrong, because I really value that in people. I value intellectual curiosity. So I think that's been a kind of a hallmark of my career. And I value enjoying my life and having fun. You know, it's important to plan for the future, but I try not to get hung up on money, and, you know, we can get hung up in day-to-day problems, but I try to really focus with mixed results on living my life well.
Brilliant, Jeremy. And Jeremy, would you rather be somebody who wins but doesn't have any issues at all? Or would you rather be somebody who maybe falls that little bit short and learns something new?
Probably somebody who learns something new that winds up falling a little bit short, because, you know, I think a lot about how to be the best person I can be and build on the areas that I care most about. So if I come out of a certain situation having learned a lot and grown a lot, that is a really important detail for me.
Brilliant. And Jeremy, then success means different things to different people. What does success look like for you?
Yeah, it doesn't look like, you know, massive monetary gain. Even if I made, you know, $100 million, I wouldn't want to live like someone who has $100 million typically. So it's really about quality of life. It's about enjoying my life. It's about giving back and being a good person and being having strong relationships, which is, again, one of the things I'm passionate about teaching. It might surprise people with the idea of espionage and all of that, which we can talk about because I spent a lot of time talking about misconceptions. But spies are incredibly good at connecting with people. So I value the relationships and people I interact with day to day and long term and having deep ties with people.
Brilliant. And saying all that about then what defines success for you, do you think currently you're leading a successful life?
I do. You know, I think it's kind of human nature to think about where you're going, what could be different. But I'm pretty proud of the kind of varied, career I've had, the relationships I've formed, and the way I've been able to take risks and pursue the things I'm really passionate about. So I'm proud of, I think, forging a fairly unique career in life.
Brilliant. So, Jeremy, then give me a little bit of flavor. Tell me about your early life and what led you to be doing what you're currently doing today.
Yeah. Well, real quick on the early life. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, wonderful parents, great sister, went to, you know, a good college. And after college, I went overseas with a backpack and a guitar and a one-way ticket to Europe. And that was, you know, a big adventure for me in my early 20s. I kicked around the continent for a while before settling in Prague. And I spent 7 wonderful years living in Prague. I was a journalist, a freelance journalist, and I also helped build the Media Association Project Syndicate, which I'm quite proud of. We turned it from a small association of newspapers, roughly 2 dozen newspapers in mostly Eastern Europe, to a global organization with over 300 newspapers in over 100 countries by the time I left. About halfway through my time there, they talked me out of grad school and put me in charge. And then I eventually went to part-time and focused on the journalism, moved to China, and wrote from China for a few years, which was really important to my career. I guess that's the earlier side. We could get into some of the later stuff with consulting, but I'll stick to your question for now and leave it there, unless you want me to go forward.
Jeremy, tell me about what you think maybe from a business perspective, what you think maybe your biggest successes have been.
Yeah, I mean, certainly building Project Syndicate. I'm quite proud of what we were able to achieve. It's an influential organization. I'd encourage all of your listeners to go check it out. Some of the world's most recognizable names write for Project Syndicate because of the unique audience that it has. So I'm very proud of that. Some of the successes I've had in business development, I can trace directly to lessons I teach in Sell Like a Spy. So I have an example of kind of following your passion. It's a section I call Use Your Superpowers. And I talk about one of my superpowers being baseball, which I'm really passionate about. It's been a way I connect with people throughout my life. And it led, and I tell this whole anecdote, to me working for the Yankees and having them as a client where I briefed them on security issues. And it led to a really great relationship and a major highlight. And I also, at one of the consulting firms I worked, I was responsible for the second largest upgrade in the firm's history. Again, leveraging a spy tradecraft known as crawl, walk, run, which is a method that spies utilize to go after what we might call the big whale. And that's what I did with this particular client. Turned a client from paying roughly $100K to about $750,000. So it was a big success. The firm had been around for several decades, and it was the second largest upgrade in the firm's history and really helped me out a lot at that firm. So I would point to those.
Brilliant. Jeremy, you sort of touched upon like Sell Like a Spy. So give me a bit of a headline sort of feeling. What is Sell Like a Spy? What's your concept and how does it help people?
Yeah, absolutely. So the concept behind Sell Like a Spy is the idea that spies are, in my belief, the world's best salespeople, really. Their particular sale which is, you know, getting someone to essentially commit treason, is, I believe, the hardest sale to make. So they bring to bear some incredible skills. And I spent a lot of time talking about misconceptions involved in the world of espionage. It's not James Bond and Jason Bourne. You can think of spies as something like elite relationship managers for the most part. They are incredibly good at connecting with a wide range of people. And in Sell Like a Spy, I help people bring elements of spy tradecraft into their careers and also into their everyday lives, because I believe that if people can use the skills that I teach in their everyday lives, they'll fashion them into kind of second nature skills, and they'll be able to use them in the more high stakes environment of their career. And they'll also find themselves with an increased ability to influence people, connect more deeply, and overcome a variety of challenges. So Sell Like a Spy is a variety of different communication challenges. And it's not just CIA and intelligence officers. It's FBI as well. I've worked with many FBI agents, specifically a British firm I worked for is well known in the space of kidnap for ransom negotiation. So I worked with quite a few FBI agents and quite a few former chief hostage negotiators. And I teach some of the incredible skills that they bring to bear to, you know, reduce conflict, to have better negotiations, to detect deception as part of it. So Sell Like a Spy brings tradecraft from the world of espionage, but also skills related to elite law enforcement, as well as, you know, special forces in the military as well, because I've worked with closely with all of these people.
Okay, so if the fundamentals, I suppose, behind it then are to improve the sales techniques or the sales approach of salespeople, what do you think the biggest weaknesses that most salespeople have?
Biggest weaknesses. Well, I think one of the weaknesses in sales is an inability or a poor skill when it comes to taking notes. I coach people on taking notes. This is probably a little bit second nature to me as a former or current, whatever you want to call it, journalist. I was more active earlier in my career, though I still write. And I find that what happened with me working at a few different consulting firms is I would be given a book of business worth several million dollars and almost no context on these clients or a prospect list I might've been given. And I think it's a major failure of many firms that have robust business development teams that they have not instilled in their teams that they should be taking robust notes on every meeting and on every phone call. And those notes should go well beyond just the tactical details of when a proposal might be due, you know, their response to pricing. It should involve aspects of the culture of the organization you're selling to. I spent a lot of time talking to people about how culture impacts sales. You know, what the individual target, you know, prospect or client's personality is like, you know, what's going on in their lives and elements of how to connect with them. So taking notes about all of these things will create a more robust mosaic of that client, that prospect. And hopefully you get a history of years behind it so that you can understand effective details about the individuals at an organization and the culture at that organization to more effectively sell. So I think note-taking is one of the biggest weaknesses in the world of sales.
Okay. So if that's the biggest weakness in the area that you cover, have you got a favorite methodology that you teach?
For note-taking?
Not necessarily for note taking, for improving somebody's sales approach, I suppose, through your, you know, Selling Like a Spy sort of program.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the heart of the matter. You know, things like elicitation, which people really enjoy learning about, mirroring and verbal mirroring on top of the physical side, active listening. I teach a lot about active listening, why it's so hard, strategies to commit to an active listening practice. Elements of how to follow your passion to find sales success, and even the idea of disguises and cover stories within the world of espionage, and helpful analogies about how salespeople can bring these concepts into their world to amplify sides of their personality that can be helpful or de-emphasize sides depending on the challenge. But if it's, you know, helpful to talk about one particular skill to illuminate it for your listeners, I'm happy to do that, whatever you'd like.
Yeah, if you're going to take, so actually, let's just use our example, Jeremy. Like, we've got quite a consultative type sales process that we follow. So we know who our ideal client is, and we start to filter those out before we get forward to a conversation. When we get through to a conversation, what we're trying to identify is most of our clients are on a pathway, I suppose, towards some degree of financial freedom. And financial freedom is going to be defined between, realistically, financial outcomes and the hours and effort that they have to put in. And we'll identify roughly where they are on that pathway. And then we'll try and understand the challenges that they see before them. And then we look to identify how we can relate to their challenges and how we've helped other people overcome those and move forward towards the desired outcomes that they want. So we're sort of trying to, if you like, map them and understand them and relate to go, actually, look, we've been here. We've helped people do this before, or we've done this before, and therefore we're a guide on that journey. Given our sort of approach, where would you be picking up on it and go, oh, I'd want to delve into there because I'd want to get, you know, that's an area where you can see your methods could make improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the first things I would do would be talking about mirroring and active listening, because I think early in the process, when you're getting to know a potential prospect who might become your client, building that rapport and is really important. So I would talk about some of those strategies, but I alluded to elicitation earlier and people find that to be really interesting. So I'll focus on that for a second because, you know, I don't know your business really well, but I know it's an accountancy, and I would imagine maybe you're talking to two partners who are considering working with you to help make their business successful. That's a scenario that I would imagine you find yourself in occasionally, maybe, right? And, you know, I think if you're meeting with them, what I coach people in is that, you, in that scenario, will want to ask people questions and learn about them, right? But the questions that you ask and even the number of questions that you ask are really pertinent to how that relationship is going to move forward. Because if you start just peppering people with one question after another, they could feel interrogated. They could feel a little bit suspicious of intentions, a little uneasy. Sometimes people don't enjoy that. So elicitation is a communication strategy that if you're smart and canny about the questions that you're asking or the statements that you're making, they will elicit a reply that will help you understand your client or prospect better. So, and it also goes to the culture and the atmosphere and intangibles that I was alluding to earlier too. So if you're sitting with two partners who are considering bringing you in to help them chart out their financial future and their business, I would be sitting there again with, you know, the ability to take notes, though I take a lot of my notes after the meeting, but, you know, noting some of the details about how they interact. Is one person very cerebral and quiet and the other person is clearly the front face of the organization? You know, is one person self-deprecating and the other, you know, very egotistical? I would start taking the measure of the individuals and noting how, you know, the different power plays will play out. And I would look to ask certain questions that would elicit information that could help me understand things a little bit better. You know, maybe something like, tell me about, you know, the best year you had as a business and the worst year, because that might tell you certain things about how they run their business, certain habits, the pitfalls of their industry that might become illuminated and help you offer expert advice versus, you know, asking some very direct questions on that point where they might be sensitive about certain areas. So I think elicitation is a really important tool in any business person's toolkit, in any person's toolkit, really.
Jeremy, obviously you've got all this various experience from the various areas you mentioned, across journalism, music, and so on. Could you maybe take me back to a time where you didn't have the answers to a particular situation, and what did you do? And how did you make sure that you move forward in the right direction?
I'm trying to think about a really pertinent question. The first one that comes to mind is getting deported from Brazil as a journalist, which people always think is a colorful story, but it ultimately ended up with me paying a bribe to get into the country. So I don't know if I want to endorse that. look, I, because of the multidisciplinary background I have, I often find myself kind of catching up on certain areas. You know, I got talked out of grad school, so I've been picking up on international affairs ever since then, and like to think that I know as much as any grad in that respect. I've constantly had to reinvent myself because I've had a restless career where I've enjoyed new challenges. So I think it's kind of a regular part of what I do. But I don't know, I can tell my deporting story, but I'm drawing a blank on a very specific example for you.
Okay. What about maybe then, maybe switch up, right? We're talking about your program beforehand, your yep. Sell Like a Spy. Is there an outcome actually that you managed to achieve for a client at some point that actually just completely surprised you that was the outcome that you got from it?
Yeah, sure. Well, I one of the more colorful stories I worked on was in corporate investigations. And I worked a lot on China, being a former China journalist. And some of your listeners might remember there was a moment in time when pretty much every hedge fund in the world was short day trader, was trying to short Chinese stocks because it was evident that many Chinese companies were fraudulent. We were at the sharp end tip of that spear, if you will. And we had a hedge fund client, and they were interested in a company. I can now talk about it because it's been delisted, called Real Gold, listed in Hong Kong, based in Western China. And they claimed to have three mines operating. And our client thought that they were exaggerating their earnings. The public records research showed a lot of red flags and problems. But it was really when we sent an investigator to the mines in Inner Mongolia that we found some extraordinary things. We found that two of the three mines that they were using or claimed to use were a total sham. One was flooded with water. The other hadn't been used in years. And the details were amazing that our investigator got. He found small plants growing out of the road into that particular mine, which would never happen if you had heavy machinery coming in and out. So great evidence there. But the real smoking gun was when he went down to the village and he talked to the villagers who said, oh yeah, the mine, they paid us to act like we were really busy working at this mine, the ones I was referring to. So we were pretending to work while a bunch of, Westerners in suits came to watch us. So they were faking the banker roadshow, and we were able to offer evidence and testimony about that. And our client was able to short the stock, which was subsequently delisted and really make a killing as a result.
Okay. Jeremy, that probably leads me to a nice element, right? You said one of your underlying values, right, is ethics. Where you've got something like maybe in that situation, how do you balance and satisfy yourself that such an action for you is deemed ethical and that you're happy with then the process that's being followed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that I frequently operate in a gray area, and I think the industry does, and understanding your ethical lines is really important. So for me personally, I have worked as an investigator, done what's called discrete source inquiries, where you call people or approach them and try to get information. And I'm not comfortable outright lying to somebody, but I am comfortable saying, hi, I'm a journalist. I'm doing some research. Can I ask you a few questions? That's all true. And I assure them their name won't appear anywhere, and it won't. And, you know, what I find and what I teach, especially when I talk about elicitation, is that people are naturally eager to share. So, you know, if people start pressing me, who are you writing for? What is it? I'm going to say, look, maybe this isn't the right fit to talk, you know? But I think there's a gray area there, and what I won't do is lie to somebody and claim I'm a headhunter that's calling you up to ask a few questions about somebody you worked with, you know, because that's just simply untrue, and I won't do it. In the corporate investigations industry, there are some people that will dig through garbage because it's quasi-legal in the U.S. in many states. I won't do that, and I won't be a part of any firm that engages in that kind of behavior. So I think it's about understanding your own moral compass and what you feel comfortable with, and trying not to, you know, hurt people in the process.
Jeremy, take me back to like the development then of your career from the journalism and across and into then how it was now. We sort of got up to that point earlier where you'd gone and explored Europe, you'd gone over to yeah. China. How did it then shift from that element into then what you now do with your Sell Like a Spy program? Hey there, really sorry for interrupting, but I really wanted to let you know about some amazing bonus content we have available for you. You see, not only do we record behind the scenes, but also we go deeper into some of the key topics that come up during the conversation. Now, you can find out more about this and access all of it free of charge over on Facebook. Just search for the Leaky Bucket Podcast Community.
Yeah, great question. Thanks. So I came back to New York, where I'm from, and I was trying to figure out where the skill set I had cultivated as a journalist overseas, someone very interested in intelligence, someone who, looking back on my early 20s, attending diplomatic events, was certainly worked over for information from diplomats occasionally that were really spies. So I've been interested in that world for a while. When I learned about the world of corporate security, I was very intrigued. And I'm doing a lot of work in that respect today, still as an investigator with my work in Sell Like a Spy, as well as some creative projects that I have and books and such. So I think it's a really interesting niche that people don't know well and that I'm working on. But to your question, I found out about this world that people at these firms enjoy recruiting people who have backgrounds in intelligence, law enforcement, military, and journalists. So my skill set fit in very well. Because I did essentially business development work, helping Project Syndicate grow, amongst other things, managerial, strategic, I was familiar with, sales. My father was a salesman. My grandfather was. It's kind of in my blood, you could say, even. So I took on a role at these firms that was kind of half practitioner, someone who could work in investigations and half business development person. And that was a lot of fun because I learned about everything from the world of like kidnap for ransom negotiation, executive protection, threat assessments, political risk advisory work, along with the more natural area of investigations and intelligence gathering. And I found that I fit in very well. And in terms of building into Sell Like a Spy, I wound up collaborating very closely with many former intelligence officers. And it was a thrill to work with these people, and I started to note things that they were incredibly good at, like being able to talk with such a wide group of people. Because what I talk about in Sell Like a Spy is that, in the business world, we often have to, try to relate to a wide group of people. But think about the challenges that spies face. They have to recruit people they wouldn't necessarily be friends with, like criminals, terrorists, diplomats from some of the world's worst regimes. They're often the targets of spies. So their human intelligence, their human connectivity abilities are just unbelievable. So I started watching them, how they relate, asking them questions and learning from them. And I did that for well over a decade. And it informed my ability to collect intelligence. It informed my ability to connect with people in my career, my everyday life. And I've practiced leveraging this tradecraft into my career and everyday life for well over a decade. And in the last couple of years, I started to realize how much I wanted to write a book about it, to teach these methods, and how fun that would be. And that's exactly what I'm doing now.
Brilliant. Jeremy, if you were gonna rewind and go and maybe talk back to an 18-year-old self, would you be giving yourself any advice and guidance of where maybe what not to do, or maybe to make sure what you do?
Yeah, perhaps. I'm pretty introspective in that way. I think that at times I've maybe jumped around to different jobs a little bit more than I would have. I probably would have stuck it out at a couple of different jobs, but I also would have told my 18-year-old self to really trust your instincts and continue on the path that feels the most righteous and passionate for you, because I'm proud of the fact that I didn't take kind of a linear path or pursue kind of a steady state, growth that I think was kind of the path in front of me. So I would have encouraged my 18-year-old self to continue to follow your convictions and try to build that career that is out there for you.
Jeremy, obviously you've got some quite strong opinions in terms of the world of sales and that side of stuff. Have you got a particular thought strategy or a particular angle that you come at that actually almost nobody else within the industry agrees with you about?
Well, I'm sure there are people who agree with me a little bit on this, but it's not standard practice. What I think the big the Achilles heel of sales is this just overly strong focus on quota attainment. And look, I get it. You know, salespeople need to be measured in some way. We all in the business world need to be measured in some way. But I have seen, you know, the baby thrown out with the bathwater way too many times. And really talented salespeople either leave because of the pressures regarding quotas and not attaining it, or being pushed out or even, you know, fired because of not attaining a quota. And what I've seen is that you could be the greatest salesperson in the world, but if the market isn't there, or the product or service doesn't measure up, you're not going to be successful. So, you know, I think what I tell people in Sell Like a Spy is, as part of a conviction of how important salesmanship is, that unless your product or service is totally differentiated from the competition, and or you have a price point that blows the competition out of the water, it's salesmanship that's going to be such a critical part of it. But we don't look at that oftentimes when it comes to evaluating salespeople, business development people. And I think it's ridiculous, because you wind up training a biz dev person who is an effective account manager, who a manager could see as a very eloquent spokesperson for your product or service. And then the market isn't there, or it's a tough quarter, and that person loses money and or is even asked to leave, even though they're great at talking about your firm. So I think it's unwise the way businesses focus more on quota attainment than they do on whether this person is a great, you know, spokesperson for our organization and how to improve some of the other areas around that.
So Jeremy, if I'm a business owner and I've got somebody that I've hired them, I've got them in place as a sales manager or whatever, but maybe I don't have any major tangible results yet. How do I know whether I've got that top sales manager? And they maybe just need some time in order to perform and get to that level when they're not hitting, you know, their scorecard, their quotas or whatever. Or if I've just got somebody who maybe was able just to talk a good game in terms of getting the job, but actually doesn't really have the underlying skills.
Yeah, well, if I'm the manager, I'm going to do a couple different things. I'm going to, you know, join some sales calls, whether in person or on the phone, preferably both, and hear about how the person does performing, you know, describing the organization and, you know, reacting to client objections. I wouldn't join just the initial pitch call. I'd join the second or third call. I would join, depending on the business, whether it's a revenue recurring business, I would join a, you know, renewal call if there's a retainer, and see how they perform in those different settings. If it puts too much of your individual on the spot, which it could, I would encourage regular recordings of these type of Zoom, you know, discussions or phone calls so that I could evaluate from there. I would solicit the opinion of other colleagues, of other people that they interact with on other teams. So I would look at a different kind of matrix beyond just the sales quota team, and to take the measure of the individual that I have hired, invested in, and is now a part of the team before I send them on their way for not necessarily hitting their quota.
Jeremy, let's go back to your various travels, right? So you leave America with no real clear prospects of where you're going. It was just like, yeah, I'm off and let's see what happens. Yeah. How did you overcome that fear? Because surely there must have been fear, first of all, in terms of making that leap. So one, how did you overcome that? And two, how did you make sure that you were being fulfilled during that time? And actually what you weren't doing was just chasing a job to pay the bills you needed in order to move to the next location or survive in the current location?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It brings up a part of my story that I don't tell that much, which is I graduated from University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Western Massachusetts, great college town. And as I mentioned, I'm a musician. I had a band at the time. I was 22 and excited about this band and wanted to, you know, see if we could really give it a go. And I was bartending at a prominent hotel, fancy hotel. And two people came in and they started doing an interview. It's an off hour at my bar. I thought it was for the local newspaper. It turns out it's for the New York Times. And the person being interviewed was a prominent location manager. And he was a great guy, involved me in the conversation. And it turns out he was scouting for a movie in the area. And it turns out it was a big DreamWorks picture with Annette Bening, Robert Downey Jr., a movie that actually wasn't that great, called In Dreams, not many people might have seen. But they offered me a job on the movie running the construction shop, and it changed my life. I was an English major. I could barely change a light bulb, so I'm not good with my hands. But it really thrust me into a new situation. And I was failing badly at first, and I was going to potentially get let go. But some people saw that I was really struggling mightily and tried to help me. And I managed to make it work, and I persevered. And I came away from that experience feeling like there was nothing I couldn't do. So there I am, a young guy, you know, with all the, you know, details that go into being a young, quasi-egotistical person. I suppose, you know, you think you're invincible when you're in your early 20s. But I just had this experience where I overcame a really significant challenge. I was working from like 6 a.m. till 9 p.m. and it took my band away because it just changed my life and I wasn't able to do it. And I thought about moving to New York and taking on some of the offers I was getting to work in locations in film. But I had a pivotal conversation in my life with somebody out, you know, towards the end of the film, having drinks at a bar, and related that. And I said, but I had always dreamed of moving to Europe after college and living as a writer, a musician. And she said, well, now's the time to do it. You just saved all this money. You haven't had a life really for 6 months. Now's the time. People won't forget you. So go to Europe. You don't have this apartment in New York yet. And if you want to come back in 3 months, 6 months, or even a year, the connection will still be there. And it was a major life epiphany for me. And that's what led me to go overseas with dreams of being some combination of Kurt Cobain meets Ernest Hemingway. And as for your question, you know, I kind of kicked around Prague for a few months, and then I found this amazing opportunity to work with Project Syndicate. And I had been writing for some of the local magazines and newspapers. It was a big expat scene in Prague. But I needed to pay the bills. And I was really lucky to hook up with Project Syndicate and then work for them for 9 years and not have to think about, you know, moving around and paying the bills, just having what was the most fulfilling job I've had in my career.
Jeremy, was there a favorite country or city or location through your various travels?
Yeah, I mean, so many. When I think about cities, you know, I certainly love Prague. I have just deep affection for the city and my time there. I love Hong Kong, and I'm very sad about what's happened to it with in recent years with China. I think it's one of the most exciting and alluring cities in the world. I love the Mediterranean. So if you get out of cities, I love to spend time in the Mediterranean as well. But I would put Hong Kong up there as one of the most exciting, alluring, and unique cities I've ever experienced.
With the various areas that you mentioned as well, obviously there's quite different cultures between each of those areas. How long did you find that it took you to settle and understand the culture well?
In Prague, you know, it was one thing, you know, and it took a while. I think one of the first things I learned in Prague and in the Czech language was the phrase "to není možné," which means "it is not possible," which was a knee-jerk reaction, kind of post-communist response. And, you know, usually I grew up in America where, you know, the customer is always right. And, you know, there was that can-do attitude. There was not a can-do attitude in Prague in the late 90s. And I think that's why I got put in charge of Project Syndicate at an early age, being a kind of naturally entrepreneurial American. So that took some getting used to. I think China was an even bigger challenge. I'm a really candid, straightforward New Yorker who tells you what he thinks, you know, wears his heart on his sleeve. And China was a major challenge in that way. The Chinese are not good at telling you no. They do not necessarily tell you clearly where you stand. That was a major challenge for me, being someone who values candor and straightforwardness. So I don't think I ever fully adjusted to any of the countries I was in. And in Prague, I wound up speaking Czech a little bit and getting comfortable. But it's still being a foreigner. And frankly, I enjoyed that very much. One of the draws for me growing up in kind of suburban America, and I'm very lucky to have grown up the way I did, you know, it was maybe a little bit boring. It's never boring being overseas. And that's one of the things I loved about being an expat. You're always looked at a little funny. You're always, you know, a little different. And I found that to be exciting and missed it in many ways.
Jeremy, on your sort of journey, through that, have you got any particular business or self-help books that you particularly helped you and guided you through in those times?
I don't know if I have self-help books during that time. I think that Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss is one that I've read in recent years that helped me shape my thoughts on Sell Like a Spy and how I might approach it. And that's the one I would point to the most.
Yeah, brilliant. Good book. Actually, it's quite a good thing. How much of is there similarities between your approaches and Chris's approaches?
I think there's certain elements of negotiation and how Chris approaches tense environments that I tend to teach from as well. I actually have as a partner somebody I work with named Stephen Romano, who's a former chief hostage negotiator at the FBI, and Chris worked for Stephen. So a lot of the things that Stephen and I work with clients on, detecting deception, cooling dramatic encounters, negotiation, are things that Chris talks about in Never Split the Difference. I just think we put our own spin on it with what we teach more broadly in Sell Like a Spy.
Right. Have you got some kind of favorite productivity hack or anything that you do that really makes you just get the most done?
You know, one of the things that I'm in the habit of doing is I have a Word document that I keep open and I label it, you know, Q1, Q2, Q3, or Q4, depending on, you know, what part of the year we're in. And I keep it as a running log of my to-do list. And, you know, I put the date and then I bullet out, you know, different areas. I have Sell Like a Spy, and then below that, my work and investigations, maybe the personal bullet below that. And I look at it all day long to try to keep on track of what I want to achieve that day. And I find it very satisfying when I put a strike through line through any aspect of it and move forward. So that's a big part of how I try to maintain productivity. But I also find that, especially working on my own these days, taking time for myself is really important too. So a lot of, if I don't check myself, I can just wind up feeling like it's, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I've been working since 7:30 and I haven't done anything. So whether it's, you know, picking up my guitar for 15 minutes or getting out for a quick workout, I think that's a really important part of my productivity as well.
Brent, Jeremy, when do you get your best work done? Are you a morning person, afternoon, evening? Where are you at?
It's kind of shocking for me to say that, because for many years I was such a night owl. But I've really, you know, now that I'm in my 40s, become more of a morning person. I wake up earlier than ever, and I think that certainly my most productive periods are working right when I get up and have a cup of coffee. That's the most productive time of the day for me.
Jeremy, what do you think some of your biggest challenges that you've experienced during your career are? And how did you make sure you overcome them?
Yeah, I think one of them is that I got talked out of grad school, as I mentioned, put in charge of Project Syndicate. And that, I don't regret that, but it has led to, you know, occasionally applying for a certain job where they'll only consider grad, you know, people with a grad degree, even though I think I know as much as people who went to some of the schools that I was going to go to. So sometimes you just can't overcome that. But I think that I overcame it generally by direct experience on the ground, by being a voracious reader and soliciting information from wherever I can. And in terms of other challenges, I think having shifted careers a few times, you know, doing journalism, doing corporate consulting, now doing this kind of teaching and coaching and training, keynote speaking, you know, sometimes presents challenges shifting into different careers. But to me, that is exciting and has made for intellectually stimulating career, and constantly chasing new horizons is fun.
Brent, Jeremy, where can people come and find out more about you, about your program, your skill, like Sell Like a Spy type side of things? Where can people find out more?
Yeah, the best place is to go to my website, which is www.selllikeaspy.net. So Sell Like a Spy is all one word, www.selllikeaspy.net. Or connect to me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on there. I'm not one of these, you know, people who's posting all the time and cultivating a huge following. I probably should. But it is something that I look at regularly, and you should be able to find me on there quite easily. And I will post when I have articles published in the different places where I write. So those are the best places to reach out to me.
Brilliant. Jeremy, we've got a bit of a tradition of a closing question on this podcast, but I think this one may be a challenging one, being you've got so many different aspects to your career already. And that's, if you were going to start a new business tomorrow, but it was completely unrelated to what you do already, what would it be and why?
You know, a long time ago, I kicked myself that I didn't start this because I think it would have been valuable. And I think there are people doing this kind of thing now. But I remember thinking about it in like 2001, 2002, a kind of a ratings agency, a Moody's, a Fitch for environmental compliance, so that consumers can take a look at a given company, an airline, a hotel chain, and have all of the information at their fingertips about making good environmental decisions, and then encouraging those businesses to comply with this rating as it got more powerful. That's something I've kicked around for a while too, and maybe someone will hear it and iterate on it right now, but that is something I've thought about.
Fantastic. Jeremy, thank you again so much for being a guest on the podcast. Thank you for being so open around all the various areas of your life and your career, and maybe helping some people learn how they can, I suppose, learn from your experiences and how they can move their life forward. So, yeah, thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Leaky Bucket Podcast. I'd love it if you could help spread the message by clicking subscribe and leaving a review. Also, please do reach out to me on LinkedIn and let me know your thoughts on this episode. You can also find more info and links in the show notes below. See you next time. Coming next week on the Leaky Bucket Podcast.
You talk to a lot of business owners and you're nodding, so I'm guessing you have the same experience. But you say, well, tell me about your business plan. And they go, look, the business plan is in my head. I go, great, okay, so tell me about your business plan. Well, I'm going to grow the business. Great, how? And then they just get stuck. You know, so when it's not documented, it's not thought through. You know, grow your business is a concept. It's not a strategy. It's not a plan. It's just a concept.